I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
Monday, September 6th is Labor Day this year in the United States. The day to celebrate working people became a federal holiday in 1894. U.S. President Grover Cleveland signed the law, making the first Monday in September a holiday. Because Labor Day started so many years ago, many Americans do not think about the meaning of the holiday. Instead, it is a day to enjoy free time with friends and family. It is also considered the unofficial end of summer. Many children go back to school after Labor Day, and many traditional summertime businesses like amusement parks and ice cream shops reduce their hours after Labor Day. In 2021, however, people around the U.S. thought a lot about the way they make a living. That is because the COVID-19 health crisis changed many things in the U.S. Many businesses shut down or had employees work from home starting in March 2020. Many office workers feel as if they are better off working at home because they do not have to spend time getting to their workplace each day. They now have more time to spend with family and do fun activities. But people who own manufacturing and food businesses are in trouble. There are shortages of some products because factories were shut down. Drinking places and restaurants are having trouble finding workers. Now, some restaurants are paying workers more money and offering extra pay to people who start jobs. In Washington, D.C., the owner of Busboys and Poets, a popular restaurant and bookstore, recently announced every employee would earn at least $15 an hour. Andy Shalal is the owner. He told a local television station that he will also help his employees go to college and get better medical care. During the health crisis, workers are thinking of finding new jobs or going back to school. A study by the Washington Post and George Mason University in Virginia found that about 30% of workers under 40 are planning to change jobs soon. Other workers tried to organize in 2021. For example, people who work for online seller Amazon in the southern state of Alabama tried to form a labor union earlier this year. Unions are organizations of workers who negotiate as a group to ask their employers for more money, better conditions, or more time off. Ruth Milkman is a professor at the City University of New York. She studies labor. Milkman said more people are interested in being in unions today than before.
You know, among young people, and especially college-educated young people, unions are cool again. You know, there's a real interest that we haven't seen for quite some time in organizing.
One reason for that is the difference in income between the highest paid workers in the U.S. and the average worker. Liz Schuler is president of the AFL-CIO, a big organization made up of 56 labor unions. During a recent event organized by the Christian Science Monitor newspaper and shown by the television network C-SPAN, she spoke about income inequality. She said it takes Jeff Bezos, the former head of Amazon, 7 seconds to earn the amount of money that the average Amazon worker makes in 1 year.
That's not right. There should be a way for workers to come together and actually get their fair share of the wealth that they're creating for companies like Amazon.
Workers protested for fair pay and other protections in the early days of the labor movement in the U.S. The Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938 established a minimum wage. The last time the federal minimum wage was raised was in 2009. Some local governments in the U.S. want to make $15, the minimum wage. However, the AFL-CIO believes the minimum wage should be closer to $24. The Congressional Budget Office does research for Congress. It reported in February that if the U.S. were to raise the minimum wage to $15 by 2025, it would result in the loss of about 1.4 million jobs. But the office said about 900,000 people would no longer be considered poor. President Joe Biden spoke about raising the minimum wage during his presidential campaign, but an increase was dropped from the recent $1.2 trillion spending deal passed by Congress. Some labor advocates say the best way for workers to earn more money is to unionize. However, they say laws in the U.S. make it easy for businesses to interfere with employees who want to form unions. Labor unions want politicians to vote for a bill called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. Jonas Loeb is the director of communications for IATSE, a union that represents people who work for theater, movie, and television productions. He said, although people seem to support unions, it is often hard for employees to come together and join one.
Just because people want to join and form unions doesn't mean that they will be able to, right? And this is why I think what happens next hinges so much on what happened in Washington.
Milkman believes that the average person has a good opinion of unions and has sympathy for low-paid workers and their problems. But she warned, gains made by workers during the coronavirus crisis may not last long.
Once the labor market is no longer one of a shortage of low-wage workers, I think you can assume that employers will cut wages.
I'm Dan Friedell.
A new study has found that future missions to Mars should be limited to 4 years to protect astronauts from harmful radiation. The study also says that missions should be carried out during specific times to reduce the level of exposure to dangerous particles. The U.S. space agency NASA currently has plans to send astronauts back to the moon. It also plans to one day send astronauts to Mars. Those plans include missions that would keep astronauts in space for long periods. China has also announced plans to send astronauts to Mars by 2033. Such missions present great risks to humans because of the high level of radiation in space. Radiation exposure can cause a series of health issues, including skin burns, heart problems, and cancer. NASA has spent many years studying ways to protect human space travelers from radiation. On Earth, we also experience exposure to radiation from the sun. But our planet's magnetic field protects us from dangerously high levels. Two main kinds of radiation can affect humans and equipment in space. One is produced by particles released from the sun. The other comes from high-energy particles created by cosmic rays from outside our solar system. NASA says the second kind can be more dangerous to humans and more destructive to equipment. In the new study, researchers used modeling methods to predict levels of radiation exposure during future space missions. They combined geophysical models of particle radiation with models for how radiation would affect human passengers and spacecraft. The International Group of Researchers recently published their study in Space Weather. The results showed that the best time for a human spaceflight to Mars would be during what is known as solar maximum. This is a period within the sun's magnetic cycle that experiences the most intense solar activity. The researchers said in a statement that this period would be a good time for a flight because the most dangerous and energetic particles from distant galaxies are deflected by the enhanced solar activity during solar maximum. The study also found that a round-trip mission to Mars should not last longer than 4 years. A longer mission would expose astronauts to dangerously high amounts of radiation, even if the trips to and from Mars were made during safer travel times. The average flight time to Mars is about 9 months. The spacecraft used for carrying astronauts to Mars would require special protective shielding, the study found. But the researchers said this protective material cannot be too heavy. If the material is too thick, it could actually increase the amount of secondary radiation the astronauts could be exposed to. The research team included scientists from the University of California, Los Angeles. UCLA research geophysicist Yuri Spritz was a co-writer of the study. He said the findings suggest that future missions to Mars can be safe for humans as long as they follow the research recommendations. Spritz said, "This study shows that while space radiation imposes strict limitations on how heavy the spacecraft can be and the time of launch, and it presents technological difficulties for human missions to Mars, such a mission is viable. NASA is currently working to develop several kinds of solutions to protect humans serving long-term space missions. Possible solutions include building temporary shelters, developing high-tech protective clothing, or deploying special shields above Mars to block radiation. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell the story of how a British attack on Fort McHenry in the port of Baltimore led to the Star-Spangled Banner, America's national anthem. In the summer of 1814, British forces attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol building, the White House, and other public buildings. Then they withdrew to their ships in the Chesapeake Bay. British General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn led the attack on Washington. Next, they planned to attack Baltimore. But the people of Baltimore expected the attack and began to prepare for it. 50,000 of them built defenses around the city. The port of Baltimore was protected by Fort McHenry. The guns and cannon of the fort could prevent British ships from reaching the city. The British began with a land attack against Baltimore. General Ross, Admiral Cockburn, and about 4,000 British soldiers landed at North Point, a finger of land reaching into the Chesapeake Bay. From North Point, it was a march of about 22 kilometers to Baltimore. The British began marching at about 7 in the morning. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn stopped their men after an hour. The two commanders and several of their officers rode to a nearby farmhouse and forced the family living there to give them breakfast. When the British officers finished eating, the farmer asked General Ross where the British were going. "To Baltimore," he answered. The farmer told Ross that he might have some difficulty getting there because of the city's defenses. But the British general replied, "I will eat supper in Baltimore or in hell." When they returned to the march, Ross and Cockburn moved far in front of the British forces. A group of several hundred Americans opened fire on the British officers. Ross was hit. He died soon afterward. The Americans retreated, but they slowed the progress of the British soldiers. It was late the next day before the British force arrived to face the army of Americans near Baltimore. The Americans were on high ground and had about 100 cannon to fire down on the British. The British commander ordered his men to rest for the night. He sent a message to the British warships to attack the city with guns and mortars. Such an attack, he felt, might cause the Americans to fall back. But the British ships had already been firing at Fort McHenry since early morning. The British guns were more powerful than those of the fort. The strength of their guns let the ships fire from so far away that the American guns could not hit them. Shells and bombs from British mortars fell like rain over Fort McHenry, but few Americans in the fort were hurt or killed. Most of the rockets and shells exploded in the air or missed. Many of them failed to explode. At the center of the fort flew a large American flag. The flag could be seen by the soldiers defending the city and by the British warships. The flag was also seen by a young American named Francis Scott Key. Key was a lawyer who had once thought of a life of religious work. He was also a poet and writer. He opposed war, but he loved his country and joined the army in Washington to help defend it. When the British withdrew from Washington, they took an American doctor named William Beans with them. Francis Scott Key knew the doctor and asked President Madison to request the British commander to release him. President Madison wrote the request, and Key agreed to carry it to Admiral Cockburn. Key also carried letters from wounded British soldiers in American hospitals. In one of the letters, a British soldier told of the excellent medical care he was being given. Cockburn agreed to free the doctor after he read the reports that his wounded men were receiving good medical care. But Cockburn would not permit the doctor or Key or a man who came with him to return to land until after the attack. So Francis Scott Key watched from a British warship as the shells and rockets fell on Fort McHenry. Years later, he said, "I saw the flag of my country waving over a city, the strength and pride of my native state, a city devoted to plunder and desolation by its assailants. I witnessed the preparation for its assaults. I saw the array of its enemies as they advanced to the attack. I heard the sound of battle. The noise of the conflict fell upon my listening ear and told me that the brave and the free had met the invaders." All through the rainy day, the attack continued. Dr. Beans, watching with Key, had difficulty seeing the flag. He kept asking if the stars and stripes still flew above the fort. Until dark, Key could still see it. After that, he could only hope. Britain tried to land another force of men near the fort, but the Americans heard the boats and fired at them. The landing failed. Shells and rockets continued to rain down on Fort McHenry. At times, the fort's cannon answered. That told Key that the Americans had not surrendered. The British troops east of Baltimore spent most of the night trying to keep dry. Commanders could not decide if they should attack or retreat. Finally, orders came from the admiral: withdraw to your ships. A land attack against Baltimore's defenses would not be attempted. At first light of morning, British shells were still bursting in the air over the fort. The flag had holes in it from the British shells, but it still flew. The British shelling stopped at 7 o'clock. Key took an old letter from his pocket, and on it he wrote a poem about what he had seen. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave? Americans sang these words and remembered the attack on Fort McHenry. Then, in 1931, Congress made the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. The unsuccessful British attack on Baltimore was followed by news that Britain had also suffered a defeat to the North. British General George Prevost had led 11,000 soldiers south from Montreal to New York. At Plattsburgh, on the western shore of Lake Champlain, his army was opposed by fewer than 4,000 Americans. General Prevost believed he needed to get control of the lake before moving against the American defenders. He requested the support of 4 British ships and about 10 gunboats. A similar-sized group of American ships also entered the lake. In a fierce battle, the American naval force sank the British ships. The Army decided not to attack without naval support. The 11,000 British soldiers turned around and marched back to Montreal. By the time of these battles, the United States and Britain had already agreed to discuss peace. The peace talks began in the summer at Ghent in Belgium. At first, the British were in no hurry to sign a peace treaty. They believed their forces would be able to capture parts of the United States. Britain demanded as a condition for peace that the United States give large areas of its northwest to the Indians. It also said America must give Canada other areas along the border. And Britain would not promise to stop seizing American sailors and putting them in the British Navy. But British policy at the peace talks changed after the battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.